We're getting morning after reaction on the 17th annual State of the Tribes address on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Glad you could be here. Before the legislature, John D. Johnson Sr., president of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, said harvesting walleye is just one hot button issue. His tribe shares life-sustaining resources with the community.
Yet our tribal members, when we do this, we're still harassed every year. Threatened, sometimes we're shot at, or even assaulted for harvesting fish, other resources to provide for our communities. Even though we restock countless lakes and fish and seek to protect, manage, and sustain natural resources for future generations, this behavior stems from ignorance.
Did you listen to the speech? What hit home? 800-642-1234. Larry Nesper directs the American Indian Studies Program and is an anthropology professor at UW-Madison. He wrote The Walleye War, The Struggle for Ojibwe Spearfishing and Treaty Rights. Larry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, thank you, Kate. It's good to be here, and good morning to all your listeners.
Good morning to you. Top line takeaways first. What did you think of the speech?
I really enjoyed the speech. I really appreciated hearing the word treaties mentioned within about three sentences of the beginning of that. It's the importance of recognizing that the tribes are sovereign entities, that they are there's an interdependence between tribal governments and the state governments. I think he also hit on the importance of casinos as revenue-generating entities for purposes of all of the different functions that the tribes take care of. We could go into those if we'd like to at some point. I also liked the point he made about old Abe. He talked about this eagle that was the symbol or the mascot, an appropriate mascot for the 8th Wisconsin Regiment during the Civil War. And it was he introduced that first before he got into the topics of inappropriate mascots, yeah, which I thought was an interesting kind of juxtaposition.
Why don't we start with the treaties? President Johnson, he brings up four treaties right away negotiated in the 1800s. He does this right away in the speech as he describes his reservation. Can you explain the significance of these treaties and how they should inform us today?
Sure. The first two that should be thought about are the treaties of 1837 and 1842, which are enormous land cession treaties, and that was effectively a transfer of trust. He used the word ceding or a land cession, and then he used the word or entrusting. In other words, he gave us this idea that Indian people have been entrusted with the land and what they as stewards of the land, and what they did was transfer that trust to the federal government, which I think is a very interesting and kind of creative way to put this. It's interesting and it's important that 1837 and 1842 treaties transferred land and also stipulated for the rights of Native people to continue to hunt, fish, and gather on those lands, which means in order that they could continue to live there and to change in the ways in which any society changes. So it was a presumption that they would continue to live there. The reservations were only created in 1854, which is, 12 and 17 years after those original treaties. Mm. So the reservations are a kind of a retrocession of the cession. So it's an interesting idea that reservations were not that well the rights that the people retained were not given by the United States, but were effectively retained by the United States. The other thing I think we
and he used the word negotiated as well.
Yes, right. Of course, because the United States wanted the treaty in order to, in the first case, to cut the pine trees, and in the second case, to mine the copper on the northern part of the state along Lake Superior.
We're talking with Larry Nesper, who is director of American Indian Studies and a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. He's giving us analysis on yesterday's 17th annual State of the Tribes address before the legislature. You can join in. Did you listen to yesterday's address by President Johnson? What were your takeaways from it? 800-642-1234. Larry, President Johnson also touched on the harassment and racism that some Native peoples face while spearfishing. You wrote a book about this conflict over spearfishing. What points did you hear in yesterday's speech?
Well, it's distressing to hear that this continues. That it seemed like this was all settled in the early 90s with some lawsuits against the leadership of the protest organizations, as well as against the sheriffs, who the tribes felt were not adequately enforcing the law. They did not win that in the case of the sheriffs, but they did in the case of the leadership of the protest, and that really quieted things down. But this emerges, it seems like, pretty regularly. There are still moments. I mean, Indian spear fishermen are out on the lakes. It's nighttime. It's dark. It's fairly isolated. It's, in a sense, easy for someone to abuse them and to harass them, which is really unfortunate that this still goes on.
He also mentioned how they use the fish and how they feed the elders, and how if you did the math, it might come out to maybe 4 fish per person. Do you think that was an important point to make?
I do think. I think that it's a very different conception of subsistence activity. I noticed this when I was doing my field work in at Lac du Flambeau in 1991. We would often clean lots of fish and then take them around to different people's homes, people who were older people, typically older people who could no longer fish for themselves or for a graduation or a baptism or a feast of some kind. There's a real high priority placed on being generous with the produce of the earth on all of the reservations, but I certainly witnessed it at Lac du Flambeau and at Bad River. That's something that people take a great deal of pride in. I was just talking to one of the chairs, and he was telling me about fishing over at Mille Lacs, where they went over to Minnesota.
Like Mille Lacs, yeah.
They got quite a bit of fish, and took them 14 hours to clean all the fish, and then they went around and distributed them to the elders and to other people on the reservation.
And it's notable, too, to do this in a pandemic when there is, you know, when people really need this help.
Exactly, exactly. And often, you know, confined to their homes. No, that's really true. Go ahead.
Well, how do attitudes on resource management, how do they differ in tribal communities versus the rest of Wisconsin, and also that relationship with the DNR?
Well, I would say that fish are not commodities on the reservation, that they are really for purposes of creating social relationships between people. Unlike, I think, a lot of natural resources, fish particularly, are consumed by individual persons in the dominant society for the most part. The restrictions on the amount of fish people can take don't encourage the kind of generosity that we see in the tribal context. I think that there are tribes don't describe themselves as stakeholders, I don't think, in this. That's a vocabulary that is kind of a strongly corporate and capitalist kind of view of what the natural world is supposed to be all about. People talk about the natural resources, what we call natural resources, as persons, right? Mm. This whole issue that we had over the wolves, the trees are persons. They're non-human persons. They have spirits. They have to be spoken to in a proper way. They have to be given offerings of tobacco when you take the bark from the trees, or you take the rice from the lake, or the fish, or the deer. All of that, that's a very personal relationship that people have with those really spiritual forces, which is quite unlike the way in which we think about, well, we call them natural resources. You do stuff with natural resources in that sense.
Yeah. Anthropologist Larry Nesper directs the American Indian Studies Program at UW-Madison, and he's giving us his takeaways from yesterday's State of the Tribes address delivered before a joint session of the legislature. What questions do you have about spearfishing and netting and other sustainable fishing practices? How do you hope the legislature will address the points that President Johnson made yesterday? Join in at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment with Larry Nesper here on the Ideas Network. We're discussing yesterday's State of the Tribes address, getting your insights on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The 17th address, representing Wisconsin's 11 federally recognized Native American tribes. Here's more from John Johnson Sr., president of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, on racially based mascots. He said they remain an unhealed wound.
When your children walk out the door, when they arrive at school, what do they see every day? Do they see something they can be proud of, or do they see something that makes them feel small and ashamed?
Has your community or school taken steps to retire discriminatory mascots? How do you feel about President Johnson's words? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison Anthropology and American Indian Studies Professor Larry Nesper, who stays with us. Larry, we heard there about mascots. What did you take away from President Johnson on discriminatory race-based mascots?
Well, that they're unacceptable, and that we all should be doing whatever we can in communities that retain these mascots to eliminate them. It's disturbing that the idea that this would continue, and I think he spoke quite eloquently about the effect, and very much from the heart, about the kind of effect that this has on children.
Yeah, and, you know, I feel, too, that while there have been some progress in some areas to address this issue, it's still a huge issue in many communities in Wisconsin that these mascots linger. You know, what more does he want the legislature to do, or how can this issue be addressed?
That's a good question. I think you probably have to ask him specifically about that, because he didn't go into specifics. But I believe we've had laws in place. The law was changed, a number of years ago, that made it harder to initiate contesting the use of mascots in schools. And that might be something to look at again. For a period of time, we had a law in place that made it relatively easy to contest this, but that was changed, and perhaps that should be revisited again.
At a number of points in the speech, he talked about how Native peoples walk into worlds, and his people looked for role models who walk successfully serving both worlds. Can you uncover the deeper meaning there of living in two worlds?
That's a long-standing trope of describing the difference between the norms of tribal society and the norms of American society, and I think that it's been useful in some ways, and in other ways it has been critiqued by scholars at different times. But essentially, it's the idea that the norms in a tribal society are different than the norms in our society. There's less individualism in tribal society. There's more of an orientation toward one's responsibilities than one's rights, for example. I think that's a sort of, you know, painting with broad strokes and saying something like that. But people are very much oriented toward sort of duty and obligation and responsibilities, and of course being recognized for their fulfillment of those kinds of responsibilities socially and by other people. Mm. There's honor is an aspect of all this.
What are the critiques or the criticisms of this, of living in two worlds? What do you see there?
I think the idea that that there's greater continuity and connection between these worlds than some people represent, or that maybe worlds isn't the best metaphor for the kinds of transitions that we make, that all of us move between different social enclaves in our lives, and that, you know, that's as true of, for Native people as it is for the dominant society.
We're talking with Larry Nesper, who is director of American Indian Studies and a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. He's recapping for us yesterday's State of the Tribes address. It was delivered by John Johnson Sr., president of the Lac des Flambeaux Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, and getting your reaction to the speech at 800-642-1234. Steve in Sun Prairie is with us. Steve, what did you think of the speech?
My comment really is about the walleye fishing. You know, the science tells us that fish reproduce at a certain age, and the science tells us that they reproduce at a certain time. So the laws that were put in place were scientific-based in order to protect the entire ecosystem. This ecosystem doesn't care about a treaty. It doesn't care if the fish is being taken by the dominant society or minority society. The point of it is that the reason why these laws are in place is to protect the ecosystem. So I'd caution the guests about motives of people that are protesting. It sounds like there's some science denying going on.
Larry, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. I was impressed by how little science people understood, say, 30 years ago, when they were protesting against this. This is really about our people don't get to do what your people get to do. This is much more of a social and kind of racial conflict in that sense. But the caller is absolutely right about the science. The state had the obligation to protect the resource, and the federal government required that, and they fulfilled that obligation.
Let's look more closely at misconceptions about life on the reservation, and specifically the role that casinos have. What did President Johnson say there?
He talked about the benefits to the tribal communities of casinos in the forms of roads and bridges and public safety and sewer and water, housing, medical and dental, education, cultural initiatives, that this is a major form of income for a tribal society that does not tax its own people, and certainly it doesn't tax the industries, or if it could, it wouldn't have a strong enough tax base in order to do this. Casinos are a kind of redistributive mechanism that works to fund tribal government and tribal society.
Also mentioning, too, that noting that these jobs at the casinos are open to all people.
That's right. More than that is, the tribes are often the major employer in their region, and oftentimes, what he said, half of the tribal employees, this is not just for the casino, but for, he said, half his tribal employees are non-native people. So tribes really are economic engines in the areas where they operate.
Looking more closely at Act 31, which is the state law that was passed in 1989 mandating Wisconsin schools teach about Native American history and sovereignty and culture, what does he hope Act 31 could do in the future, how it could be strengthened?
Act 31 is a very good thing, and there's a scholar up at Green Bay, J.P. Leary, has done a book on this, and it's quite a good account of this. I think that the problem with Act 31 is that it is not strongly enforced, so that we don't get the accountability for this that we really need to have. And I think that's what President Johnson was calling for the legislator to do something about, putting some teeth into Act 31.
So making it more mandatory and perhaps the curriculum more unified among schools.
Yes, I think that would be appropriate.
What do you think the purpose of the State of the Tribes address is today versus when it was started in 2004? How do you see it resonate?
It's important to the tribes to have a venue to speak to the legislature, and I think it's important for the legislature to hear the tribal leaders speak. There's also typically a reception that takes place right after this. I don't know if they did this year because of the pandemic, but this is an opportunity for individual legislatures to talk to the tribal leaders about issues. I think people will talk about the importance of social relationships with each other that make the formal business of intergovernmental relations possible, and this is an effort to do that. So the tribes, I think, take this quite seriously. They appreciate the opportunity to address this joint session. And then it does things like this. We get a life of this thing coming over the radio and television covering this, too. And it brings the fact that we have 11 tribes in this state, actually 12, one unrecognized tribe, to the foreground and causes us to think about how our state is constituted in a slightly different way.
And there's also that ceremonial thank you to a number of people at the beginning of the address and perhaps saying, you know what, I see you, I recognize you.
There you go, exactly. I think that's right.
Larry, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure, Kate.
Larry Nesper is Director of American Indian Studies and a professor of anthropology at UW-Madison. Ahead this hour, we hear about new research out of the University of Minnesota that explores fighting the invasive emerald ash borer with fungi. What questions do you have about this beetle and its damage? 800-642-1234. News update is next on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about preserving memories of floods.
In recent years, Wisconsin's Driftless region has experienced some of the most severe flooding in its history. The new podcast from our partners at Wisconsin Humanities, called Human Powered, is exploring that issue in one of its episodes. Here's host Jimmy Gutierrez.
One night in late August of 2018, it started to rain in southwestern Wisconsin. That rain quickly turned into a downpour and then a flash flood. Ryan McGuire is a firefighter in Coon Valley. His pager starts going off at 11 p.m., and by 1 a.m., he's making his first rescue.
So she goes to open up her door. Now, by this time, the water's about midway in between my knees and my hip, and I'm 6 foot. And we always tell them, grab your phone, grab anybody that's in there, and grab any medications, because we don't know if we're coming back.
These floods have devastated low-lying communities like Coon Valley and others in the Driftless region, and they keep coming. In the last 15 years, there have been at least 5 so-called 100-year floods. It has people asking, how can we continue to live here?
A project called Stories from the Flood could be one of the answers. Started 2 years ago by the Driftless Writing Center, volunteers and community members have interviewed over 100 people about their experiences during flood events. These stories share grief, resilience, and even joy, but they also give us the ability to think about complex issues like flooding and climate change in a brand new way. Today, we're heading back to the Driftless region with Caroline Gottschalk-Druschke. Caroline is an associate professor of rhetoric and composition at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
I think folks who haven't experienced floods think about them maybe as a one-day event or two-day or 1 week. And really, you know, 2.5 years later now, people are still cleaning things out, rebuilding things, tearing things down. It is clear that people are super traumatized. And what if we try to help people express that and share it and understand that they're not alone in it?
People wanted to talk. People needed to talk. So Caroline and other volunteers started recording stories. And Caroline got her students involved. They heard stories of resilience, stories of hope, and also pain. For Ryan McGuire, the night of the flood is a memory he'll never forget.
I don't want to say you have PTSD, but you get flashbacks. I can go right back to that night. I can picture I'm there. I mean, I'm walking down the street and the water's up to my chest and you almost get like a shiver in your back. And, you know, and I don't know if it doesn't scare me, but it's just I'm there.
many of those storytellers then did give feedback saying that it was a really important experience for them, and it was important to be able to tell and to think through and to narrate what had happened to them, and then putting that experience in some context and putting it in connection with other people who also experienced something really, really hard right alongside of them.
It also helped her students as they themselves struggled through a school year like no other.
A lot of my students in the spring and fall said that listening to the flood stories helped them make it through COVID. Like, there was something powerful in the ways that people face something really overwhelming and awful and kind of find their way through it that gave my students a lot of peace when they were going through a similar kind of situation. And that's something that science doesn't necessarily do, you know? Science helps point us towards an answer, but I think, yeah, stories can give us equipment for living, if you will.
That story came to us from Human Powered, a new podcast from Love Wisconsin and Wisconsin Humanities. The 6 episodes of Human Powered share stories from people in communities across Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the emerald ash borer, the beetle from Asia that was first detected in Michigan nearly 2 decades ago. The USDA says it can be blamed for the destruction of tens of millions of ash trees in 30 states, including here in Wisconsin. But fungi could prove helpful in containing this invasive forest pest. Do you have ash trees? How do you feel about the spread of the emerald ash borer? It's 800-642-1234. Ben Held is a forest pathologist at the University of Minnesota. He is lead author of this new study published in the journal Fungal Biology that identifies fungi associated with emerald ash borer infestations. Ben, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So what role do fungi have in the death of these ash trees that are infected by this beetle?
Right. Well, we're finding what we found so far is that there are three different groups that we found that are important as these ash die. And one of them are canker fungi. So these fungi move into trees that are stressed usually, and they can cause cankers and kill tissue in the tree. And as the emerald ash borer, the larvae will feed on the inner bark of the tree. They produce these wounds, and over several years, these become exposed, and fungi can move in there and take advantage of that area and invade the tree. And so there are a number of different canker fungi that we found that are associated with those. And we're doing some research looking at, okay, what is their role in tree death as they probably work with the tree, or, you know, as the tree is getting attacked by EAB, will kill tissue and probably kill the tree quicker than if they weren't there. Some other fungi we found were decay fungi. So these fungi are basically, if you think of, you know, a lot of fungi decay wood plant material, okay? And so these go in there and will decompose the wood, and becomes important as these trees die. They can decompose the wood quite rapidly. And so as arborists go and try to remove these, they fall apart and become a dangerous situation, as well as when these trees die. A lot of these trees are on boulevards and streets, of course.
Yep.
And, you know, you can get them blowing over in the wind. They become a hazard too for people. And so there's that. And then the final one is entomopathogens. And so these are fungi that will attack insects. And so there are a number of different species we found that were doing that. And these are really fascinating fungi that are capable of killing, you know, different forms of insects, from, you know, the larvae to the adult beetle, possibly the eggs. And so we're doing research with some of these species to see if we can use that as a biocontrol to control this insect in a with a bio with one organism controlling another organism. That's what biocontrol is. And so instead of using, say, insecticides and different methods like that.
Yeah. Well, it seems like these fungi are taking advantage of the emerald ash borer's handiwork. You know, once the beetle does its damage, it's like the fungi is like, oh, there's an opening for me, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's what fungi do. And it's amazing to see the diversity that we've found. And you're exactly right. There's nothing wasted, so to speak, in nature. And these fungi will move in, lots of different species, take advantage of that. Basically, it's a new niche, really, because, you know, we, as an invasive, we haven't had this type of, you know, widespread stressed ash on our landscape, right? And so This is a new area that they can move in and we're finding fascinating fungi, taking advantage of it. You're exactly right.
Well, Ben, you know, part of your research has involved collecting infected ash tree samples from here in Wisconsin. Why are you doing that?
So it was found in Minnesota. It's been in Wisconsin longer than it has in Minnesota. And so the damage was more widespread than it was at the same time in Minnesota. And so we were doing some comparative analysis with some of the fungi here and saying, okay, maybe, you know, trying to figure out what the succession is and what it looks like when it's been there longer and you have, you know, more dying ash and are there certain species that are becoming dominant as more ash die. And so we were doing some, basically we're using DNA. We can sequence all the fungi that are in a sample of wood and find out the species and do some comparisons with Minnesota here.
Yeah. I mean, these ash trees come down quite often, including on my boulevard, but, you know, is it difficult to get these samples because that ash tree is either going to be treated for the life of the tree or it's coming down? How difficult is it to get your specimens?
You know, it's been fairly easy in a sense because, you know, we've had a lot of assistance from arborists and the people who are helping us with the city personnel that are removing these and tree mm-hmm. companies because what's happening really is that, you know, there's a lot that are being removed, you know, ahead of time even because the big issue here is trying to stay ahead of it. And so as you get these trees that are being attacked, they can produce a lot of adults. And so if you leave them around, then it's going to make the situation worse, right? And cities are, you know, can be overwhelmed with the cost of removing these. That's why it's one of the reasons, you know, it's been so destructive too, is that it costs a lot of money to remove these. And we're talking hundreds of millions of trees. It's no small feat. And then you have to replant or, you know, you presumably like to replant these, right? And so, you know, a lot is being removed. And so we're able to get those from those trees that are being removed.
So how do you determine whether a species of fungi may be on the side of helping the trees or hurting the trees? Because it sounds like the canker and the decay fungi may not exactly be the most helpful in terms of eradicating the beetle.
Right. So you're basically looking at, so we're identifying them by the main way we were identifying these in this study was culturing them. And so you isolate fungi from these samples, from the wood and media. And so you have an actual physical fungal culture of it. And we sequence the DNA of it. Basically it's a region of DNA in the fungus that's considered sort of like a barcode. And so you can sequence this and then you can compare it in this big database and find the identity of these species. And so there are known species of canker fungi and these that are kind of related in a sense. And so you know that that's kind of what their role is. And so you can kind of group them by those categories of canker fungi and decay fungi and entomopathogens. And so we know that, you know, the canker fungi are you know, going to be are going to be not helping the tree based on their function of what we know of other decay canker fungi, and the same thing with decay fungi. And so we're able to categorize these and understand, you know,
sort through them
on a broad level what they're doing, but we don't know exactly what their role is. And so this was a first look at, okay, you know, like we said, there's this new niche, basically. There's this resource that hasn't been available before. And what are these fungi, who's there and what are they doing? It's kind of what we're trying to answer. And and the more we look, the more we find. I mean, we look in lots of different areas and we find new species. Like this, for this study, we found, you know, 32 presumably new species. And so they're incredibly important in so many different ecosystems.
Ben Held is a researcher in the plant pathology department at University of Minnesota, has been investigating the role of fungi in emerald ash borer infestations. How has the emerald ash borer affected your community, your parks, your forest land? What do you hope researchers learn about fungi? Did you take down an ash tree recently? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Ben Held here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're exploring a potential biocontrol for the emerald ash borer, the wood-boring beetle that kills ash trees by eating under the bark. Researchers at the University of Minnesota discovered some species of fungi that attack the invasive beetle, attack other insects, that warrant further testing as a potential way to contain infestations. Do you have ash trees? Are you treating them with insecticides? Join in, 800-642-1234. We have Ben Held with us, the study's lead author and a researcher in the College of Food, Agricultural, and Natural Resource Sciences at the University of Minnesota. Catherine is joining us from Random Lake. Hi, Catherine. What would you like to say?
I planted a blue ash tree in the Richfield area, and all the ash trees around me are dead, or around that area are dead, except my blue ash. My blue ash is infected. It has sent up kind of shoots from the branches, but it's coming back this year, and I was wondering if there's any chance it has the right kind of fungi and can beat the emerald ash borer.
Ben, what do you think?
Yeah, I think there has been some evidence that blue ash is more resistant. And so did you say it has been attacked by EAB?
Yes.
But it's how many years has it since it's shown that it's been attacked?
I'm going to say 5 or 6 years.
Okay. And it's still hanging on pretty well?
It's still hanging on. It's coming back. I've checked it. It's going to be putting out leaves this year again.
Well, that's good. Yep. I would keep an eye on it. And you know, if there's any dead branches and things like that, you can trim them out or have someone do that and see how it does. But yes, there is some evidence that blue ash is more resistant. There's not too much of that around though. Yep. I'm glad you had that planted.
Catherine. Thank you.
Can I ask one more question?
Sure. Go ahead.
Should I cut off those spiky branches that are growing up that really they're coming from some of the bigger branches? They're just little twiggy things. Should those be cut off or should I just leave them alone?
You can cut those off. Those are called epicormic branching, and that happens when the trees are stressed. They'll put those out. But yes, you can trim those off.
All right, trim those up. Catherine, thanks. Jeff is joining us in Delafield with a question. Hi, Jeff.
Good morning. A couple different questions. First of all, I'm starting to lose ash trees in low-lying areas, and I'm wondering what to plant. I thought of swamp white oak, but I think it's too wet for the swamp white oak. The other thing, in my yard, I treat them with imidacloprid, I think it's called. I pour it on the ground, and now I've read that causes other problems. It's a systemic, and it can cause problems for pollinators. Hmm. So those are my two questions. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Jeff.
Yeah, sure. you know, swamp white oak should do well in the lower areas. That's probably a good choice. American elm actually does well and tolerates a lot of different environments. So that's another good choice. And if you do that, there's a number of different resistant, you know, we're talking about another invasive here, Dutch elm disease, but there are a number of different cultivars that are resistant, like Valley Forge or Princeton or St. Croix that are available. As far as the insecticide goes, you know, I'm not sure exactly on that that particular formulation, but product. You can go to if you Google EAB, Emerald Ash Borer Info. .info. There's a great publication there about different products that you can use for homeowners, soil drenches and things like that. So that gives some
that
some
has some resources yeah, there
better than I can explain right now. But.
Well, Ben, how can someone recognize whether a tree may be home to emerald ash borers? What are the signs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So what you will start to see is some dieback in the crown. So you have some branches up in the crown that'll start to die back. And as I just mentioned, your previous caller talked about these little shoots that'll grow on the sides of the tree where off the branches, little clumps of leaves. Those are epicormic shoots. That tells you that the tree is stressed. And so that's one indication. Another is as the beetle starts to progress and you have more a bigger population under the bark, you'll have woodpeckers that will actually go after the larvae underneath the bark. And so you'll have woodpecker damage around. And so, you know, little holes that they make, they'll go after the larvae and eat them. They're actually a good biocontrol themselves. But, and if you start to see those galleries or these cankers underneath, then that's a sign too. And again, that's as more advanced, that happens when the attack is more advanced and those galleries become exposed underneath the bark and it comes off. So those are the big ones.
Do you think fungi are getting enough focus, enough attention from scientists for the potential to fight invasive species like this beetle?
No, I think in general they aren't in a lot of different respects but no, and this, I think, you know, they're incredibly diverse group of organisms, and the fact that they can do this, that, you know, there are these natural methods that they use and that is out there to kind of keep things in balance in a sense, and we can utilize these. But I think this sheds good light on their capabilities and what we can use them for. And you know, hopefully as we are testing these out more, we'll find them to be very effective. And there are, you know, they've been used before for different things. And even in emerald ash borer, we have found a number of different species. So we're trying different species to see how they're going to perform and on different life cycles of the beetle, because it's kind of a complicated issue as you start to look at, okay, how are they spreading, how are you going to apply it. But
so more to come on the potential for biocontrol. Ben, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. I appreciate it.
Yeah, Ben Held is a forest pathologist for the University of Minnesota. You can find a link to his study on fungi species associated with the emerald ash borer infestations. It's at wpr.org/mornings. Just ahead, we have a conversation on cybersecurity threats and how small businesses can protect themselves. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.